from 104.5 The Zone, this is the Midday 180 queued up by Edley's Barbecue. With Jonathan Hutton, Chad Withrow, and Paul Kuharski.
Just like that, the second hour is here, Midday 180. We are queued up by Edley's Barbecue on 104.5 The Zone. The crew all here today. David Reed's the chairman of the board. Chad Withrow in Mount Juliet. Paul Kuharski in Brentwood. I'm Jonathan Hutton in Murfreesboro. Guys, the first hour flew by. And coming up, we have Wade Phillips, son of Bum, who will join us in about 25 minutes. He'll call right at 11:30. And we'll also talk with Stephen Godfrey. He's on with us in about 10 minutes. Chad?
Still getting a huge response to our pill graphic that we tweeted out there, where you get three options of all these hypothetical sports things that could have happened or could happen in the state of Tennessee. And continue giving us your votes on that. I've talked with Will Bowling, did a great job helping us with that graphic to see if he could tally those votes. He informed me that he would not be doing that. And
good,
I don't blame
you,
him.
Because that's belligerent.
There are so many responses right now. Again, we're approaching 1,000 already, and everyone is voting, obviously, three times for three different pills. But we'll get into a broad discussion about this coming up at 1 o'clock today. We unveiled it to start the show. It is blowing up on social media right now, which is really cool to see. But just a fun hypothetical practice for Nashville and Tennessee sports fans to play.
Paul, how many of these do you find super intriguing for what you're going through to select? You don't have to tell me your selections, but just the ones that you're kind of on the fence about.
Oh, I'm having trouble narrowing to three. I keep kind of changing. I would say there are five or six.
I have five starred on my list.
Yeah, that are very intriguing to me.
Hit us up on Twitter at Midday180s where you can find. You can also find it on Instagram.
Yeah, there's some that also I could cross out very quickly.
Getting from five to three was tough for me. By the way, some news coming down, guys. Aaron Nesmith of Vanderbilt declares for the NBA draft, will hire an agent. So his time as a Vanderbilt Commodore is done. Joe Rexroth tweeting, Aaron Nesmith declares for the draft, will hire an agent, will go in the first round, too. So Joe Rexroth making a declaration that he will be a first-round pick. That remains to be seen, but Aaron Nesmith declaring for the NBA draft and hiring an agent, he will no longer be a Vanderbilt Commodore.
Did Joe comment on Stephanie White's safety?
Will there be a column praising Candace Story Lee for the patience being shown to Stephanie White? This is how you build a program, patience like this. Let's applaud someone like Paul did a little bit yesterday for getting to four wins in the SEC this year. What a major step up this year to get to four whole wins in conference play.
Let me speak for Joe. Joe is picking, is not picking pill number seven, Vandy fully invest in sports, because he believes they already have.
Coming up, again, we'll have Wade Phillips on the show. Paul, the last time he joined us, I think Chad was off that week. I don't know why I think that's the case. I also thought he joined us at the fight for McGregor and Mayweather, and that wasn't true either. So who knows? But the last time he joined us, Paul, Wade was awesome with some stories. And with the book Son of Bum, we'll go through a ton of old stories with him at 11:30.
Yeah, and I want to get a few thoughts on some current things in the league. Jarrell Casey. For one, how much does he think he has left in the tank? If he's got a feel for that, I'm very curious to know it. John Elway in an NFL.com story, most GMs come out and say, trades are win-win and they don't want to piss off their trade partner and hurt themselves for next time. Right. He said Jarrell Casey trade was a steal.
He said, we're excited about how it unfolded. You never know. We still have to go win football games, but it was a good start for us this offseason with Boye trading for him at the corner position and then Jarrell Casey trading for him at the defensive tackle position that we needed, a steal in a very, very good football player, a five-time Pro Bowler. And then he goes on to discuss his backfield because they've added Melvin Gordon to that group as well. saw an interesting piece, and Paul, I think you forwarded this to me about how, you know, the discussion is on the top end of salaries for running backs, but it's the guys who are the undrafted or the low draft picks who come in at a very small salary in comparison to the top contracts around the league. And then because they're running backs, they never actually cash in on the bigger, quote unquote, bigger contract. Philip Lindsay is a great example of this.
Yeah, a guy like Philip Lindsay, I mean, he's never in the conversation about a big contract because he's just that guy, right?
Well, and if he were, it would count against him because the same argument comes up for him as it would for Melvin Gordon last year in L.A., right? I mean, it's you don't give the running back a big contract, even if the running back is an undrafted guy that has excelled to a Pro Bowl level.
Yeah, it's kind of based on where you come in, you know? So it's just such an awkward spot. And I do have a degree of sympathy. It's almost like there's no way for the running backs to unite and do something to get bigger initial contracts. But I have seen some say, like, I would hold out, not some running backs, but some analysts saying, like, I would hold out after 3 years, you know, and do everything I could. If you're a very good running back, but it hasn't worked, right? Isn't that what Le'Veon Bell did? Isn't that what Melvin Gordon did? It doesn't work. So you just have absolutely no leverage, really. And you're just not going to make – I think you have to come to terms with the fact you're not going to make commensurate money. But here, again, if Derrick Henry gets tagged 2 years in a row, he can make $22 million for 2 years. Now, is that commensurate with what a great cornerback would make for his fifth and sixth year in the league? No. But $22 million – it's not bad money. Now he's getting beat up more than guys at other positions and stuff. Is it out of whack? Absolutely. But is $22 million for your fifth and sixth year in the league pennies? No. Yeah. So, I mean, it's just a quirk in the league. It's an unfortunate quirk. And would he be better off playing linebacker? Probably.
Oh, based on contract status. Yes. Titans agreed to terms yesterday with offensive lineman Ty Sambrello, who is a veteran of 57 games across the league, 13 starts over five NFL seasons, another swing guy. And at college in Colorado State, he played all five offensive line positions. That's of note. And primarily a tackle at the NFL level. And he's a lot like Dennis Kelly, where they lined him up in Atlanta and in Denver as the quote-unquote extra tight end, and we saw him in some highlight packages that were rolling yesterday locally, catch some touchdown passes.
It's amazing, though. Everybody's immediately got this guy locked in as Dennis Kelly. I think of this guy more like Xavier Suafilo when he came in. It's a guy with some experience who's going to have to work to earn a job, and he might be on the roster, and he might not. They're going to draft a tackle still. Now, the question to me is, can he play guard? Like you said, he played guard in college, hasn't played guard in the pros. If they could turn him into a swing guy that can play tackle guard, then he could take the Kevin Pomfield role, which people hate that role because that role doesn't necessarily require you to be active on a weekly basis unless somebody in front of you is hurt. But there's high, high value. And also there's going to be an extra offensive lineman active now, right? A guaranteed eighth, is it, Hutt, offensive lineman? He could be that guy if they like him, if he can play tackle and guard. But people yesterday making it like, oh, they found their extra offensive lineman. This guy's no guarantee. He was a second-round draft pick who was then traded for a fifth-round draft pick who was then cut. No automatic.
Again, seven starts over – with his time in Denver and then six starts in Atlanta. Coming up, Stephen Godfrey joins us. And then Wade Phillips on the Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue on 104.5 The Zone.
Nonstop sports talk just got bigger. The Wake Up Zone, Midday 180, 3HL, and The Big Six. Non-stop sports talk from 6 a.m. till 7 p.m. Monday through Friday. 104.5 The Zone.
Barbecue coming up at 11:30. Wade Phillips will be on the show, but we are pleased to be joined by Stephen Godfrey, looking at the Atlanta Braves cap through Skype.
Opening day, right?
Yeah,
it's opening day. Yeah, I didn't realize that when I threw the hat on, but then somebody texted me, and it's kind of sad. It's bittersweet.
It is bittersweet, especially that you and I are Braves fans, Godfrey, and it seems when the team gets to be really good, there's just no season at that point for anyone. So that's also a bummer.
Would hurt me any season.
I guess Paul is in a similar situation, though, because the Yankees were like kind of on the up, right?
Oh, no
Very
doubt.
Much on the up.
Let's talk some college football, and specifically the NCAA, one of your favorite topics. With the Trevor Lawrence GoFundMe account to help people, and then the NCAA getting publicly shamed and coming off their stance and saying it's a university decision now, do you think this is going to signify more common sense approaches to decisions like this, where they're going to put it in the hands of the university, or is this just a one-off situation where the backlash was so bad they just had to back off?
People can see my face right now, right?
We can, not everyone.
Oh, okay, good. Because I do a usual hand motion in regard to their legislation. This was a classic example of how we perceived the NCAA incorrectly, which was they did not get involved in Indianapolis in this decision. What happened was Clemson Compliance immediately came in and said, "Hey, we've got a likeness issue here," and this basically falls under the very traditional interpretation of endorsement, right? Student athlete using his likeness for endorsement. They shut it down. Media takes that and says, "Oh, it's the NCAA." Well, yeah, technically it is, because these are the bylaws passed by the membership of the NCAA. The NCAA comes out very tactfully and says, "We didn't do anything. It's not us. In fact, we would like to make an exception to help charity here." So it's very good PR on their part. This is classic snake eating the tail. Okay, so the membership of the NCAA passes these rules. And then when one of the member institutions, in this case Clemson, feels like they should be able to have an exception, they whine about the NCAA. Well, when Clemson and all these other schools go to vote every year at the convention, they never follow up on that. So I think Indianapolis is a great boogeyman for these guys. It is very much the straw man, whipping post, whatever you want to call it. So this was an example of that. Technically, Indianapolis did not tell him no. It's just the rules that they have passed made it impermissible.
So there's a lot of talk about what college football is going to look like when they come back, and what a spring practice or an extended fall camp may look like, and how that's going to affect the product of college football. Godfrey, you've talked to a number of coaches out there, and I'm sure they have a lot of thoughts about this. What do you think is the most likely scenario to happen in terms of practice? And how will it ultimately affect the product on the field when this thing gets started back this fall?
Yeah, I've talked to a couple coaches in the last couple of days. I was talking to a personnel director for a P5 last night, and they think that right now there's an oversight committee meeting and entertaining a bunch of ideas. I don't think we'll have anything public yet. The reason being is that we as a country right now don't know how to absorb this data as it comes out daily. And the NCAA certainly doesn't, nor do any of these individual conferences. But they're monitoring. They're trying to find a trend line on, like we all are, the curve, right? Once they figure out it's going to be this bad or this good, they're going to make suggestions to some sort of amendment on spring and summer practice. So these are the two situations that I've heard that are just being considered. I want to be really clear here. They're being considered. The first is an extension of the traditional fall camp. So what that means is basically when the kids would come back after we go to media days and talk to coaches, there's a little bit of a break. Kids report. Sometimes it's late July. Sometimes it's early August. It depends. And they go to camp. There's talk of extending that out into July. Okay. So that's situation number one. The second situation would be some sort of amendment basically what we would consider like a mini camp in the NFL, where the kids, they're normally on campus in June. All right. They're there anyway. you can do a certain set of things. It's pretty limited in terms of like what you can do organized with kids in June. For instance, you cannot use a football. That's a real restriction. You cannot use a football in any activity that you do with the kids in June. They may lift that because some of these schools didn't get any spring ball. Some got 5 or 6 practices. I think some schools got like 7 or 8 in the warm weather climates. Just off the top of my head, I know that Houston got like 7 or 8 practices, right? They're not going to try and go back and meter out and say, you got this many spring practices, so we're going to give you this much time. They don't want to do that. They want to create a blanket policy. So I think from what I've heard, people like this concept of a June minicamp more than they like extending the giant fall practice into July.
So Godfrey, you've had a chance to look at our pill graphic at this point. And make your 3 choices for Tennessee/Nashville. I guess it's Nashville/Tennessee sports because there are some Vol-related pills on the list. How difficult was it to get down to 3 that you wanted? We all agreed that we kind of got to 5, and it was difficult to go from 5 to 3 in terms of what we really thought was best.
Okay, so I approached this a couple different ways. 2 main ways. As a sports writer, I've lived in Nashville for 14 years. All right. So I have no alumni status with anything in terms of collegiately in the state of Tennessee. I've only covered the sport. And then the other thing is, as a fan, the day I moved here, I said, hey, I'm going to pick up the Predators. So I'm going to be a Predators fan. Okay. So I approached it. I said, let's pick one as a fan and let's pick one as a media. And then the third one, which I'll get to in a second, is me as a Nashvillian who spent a lot of time around the city of Memphis, if that tips my hand. So number one is definitely that the Preds beat the Penguins. As a sports fan, as someone who does this professionally, I've seen one of my teams win a title my entire lifetime. That was in 1995. I would very much have, if you're stressed out, you're listening to this and things are bad, go back and remember the abundance of positive energy that went through this city for that 2-month, 3-month span of the playoffs. I remember it very well. My second child had been born. I remember sitting up nights. The Chicago series alone is probably the most hopeful sporting series I think I've ever seen. And just in terms of defying expectation, the way the community, you would go to the supermarket, you would go to church, you would go to a bar, and everyone in this city was a fan. And it's such an organic experience. I really do wish they could have closed it out. They ran out of time, I think, in terms of injury and depth. So number two, this was a little bit tougher for me. Let me do this one. So number two is Vanderbilt fully invests in sports. All right. It's not the sexiest pick, but here's my reasoning. This is very selfish as a sports media professional. I live like 1.7 miles, whatever, from Vanderbilt. It sure would be nice. And Chad always goads me into saying horrible things. It sure would be nice if they acted like an SEC program, because I have 3 kids and it would be fantastic if I didn't have to get my butt in a car every Saturday and drive somewhere else. When you have the richest, most talented football conference in college athletics, and you have, the dog end of it that is in your backyard, and there's no really end in sight now into the way in which they're mismanaging this thing. It really hurts. I just want to say that there's a lot of good people there who agree with me. So the idea of Vanderbilt fully investing in sports, just pause for a second and think about like a 7-5, 8-4 Vanderbilt team on a rough, like perennial basis. Kentucky. Yeah, exactly. A stadium, Paul. Like just how about one with like backs on seats? How about something super bougie like that, right? Imagine Kentucky football in Nashville. That's what I started telling people. A defensive-minded team that knows how to go out and identify talent in the Mid-South, pluck a couple kids out of Florida, run the ball, upset a few teams, and be a step better than Kentucky, South Carolina, Missouri. That's all possible. So that's, as a very selfish as a sports writer, I would very much like that. And then number three is, I've lived in Nashville longer than anywhere else in my life, and I've also had to experience a lot of this bizarre, I don't know what you guys call it in Tennessee, this sibling rivalry with Memphis. And one of the things that I know, I'm sure Paul could like elaborate on the history, the city of Memphis, like it's the Nashville Titans. It absolutely is the Nashville Titans. It has to be, guys. I don't understand. The city of Memphis hates the Titans. Are we all aware of this?
You guys? Oh, yeah.
Oh,
we hate Memphis. Chad's day.
Well, and Tennessee fans hate the name Tennessee Titans because they want to always be known as Tennessee, and they don't like hearing Tennessee because they're immediately thinking Vols, where we hear Titans and think Titans.
Yeah. Godfrey, thank you as always, man. We appreciate the quick hit via Skype, and we will catch up soon.
Yes, sir. Thanks, guys.
Stephen Godfrey, you can follow him on Twitter at Godfrey38. Coming up, Wade Phillips, Paul. The new book is Son of Bum, and we go down memory lane with the former head coach of the Cowboys, of course, longtime defensive coordinator, and the son of Bum Phillips, which the book is dedicated to.
It's always terrific. It's going to be good.
Wade Phillips next, Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue on 104.5 The Zone.
With an ever-changing landscape that has affected the sports world and our community, 104.5 The Zone brings you the spirit of Sports Fest. It's the annual event where we catch up personally with you. Tune in all day Friday as we show our appreciation for our community with live and local programming, including your favorite shows with very special guests and more. The Spirit of Sports Fest, all day Friday on 104.5 The Zone.
The Midday 180 queued up by Edley's Barbecue on 104.5 The Zone. Pleased to be joined by Wade Phillips. The new book is Son of Bum, where he recalls his life in football and tells the memories of his father, NFL head coach Bum Phillips, in a book perfect for Father's Day. And Wade is joining us by phone. Coach, so great to have you back on the show. How are you today?
Hey, great. Yeah, I hope everybody's safe there, certainly.
Yes, absolutely. Coach Mack, Dave McGinnis, first off, wanted to know if your legendary football clinic in West Texas is still a go.
Yes, the Angelo Clinic is still on, and I'll be there this year, so every year.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those that don't know, that is the clinic of all football clinics that go on in the off season there, and it takes place in West Texas. Wade Phillips on the line with us. Your dad, Bum Phillips, coached you in high school. And then Bear Bryant hired him on his staff at Texas A&M, but Bear would not call your dad by his nickname. Why not?
I don't know. He didn't want to call somebody Bum, I guess. My dad always said, hey, as long as there wasn't a preposition, A or D in front of it, it was okay to call him Bum.
Bum Phillips, the legendary coach, the memories of all of him and the coaching advice that he would give his son, Wade Phillips, who joins us by phone. You can get the book, Son of Bum, available right now. And again, the perfect gift for Father's Day.
Wade, Paul Kaharski here. Good talking to you. Wondering, from a Nashville perspective, Mike Vrabel looks like he's in line to be his own defensive coordinator. Curious what you think about a head coach doing the double job. How difficult is that? Did you do that when you were head coach? And what are your general thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, that's, Mike, that's what he does really well. And that's, how he got the job. So, and I did do it at Dallas 1 year, and we actually won the division and won the playoff game. So, it's different for different coaches. But certainly he feels like that's the thing to do. And, his expertise certainly on defense. So I think, he's going to help their defense.
They just lost or traded for just a 7th-round pick, but got rid of a lot of salary. Jarrell Casey, he's around 30. Wondering how good a player you still think he is. John Elway said he thought he got a steal.
He looked, when I've seen him play, he's always been a good player, obviously. You got to know that. So 30 years old shouldn't be too old, but we'll see. Everybody has different opinions, and we'll see how it works out.
Wade Phillips, our guest on the Midday 180. Wade, you were in the locker room before the Gator Bowl in what was Bum's first season on Bear Bryant's staff at A&M. Will you give the details of the pregame speech that Bear gave to his Aggies that day before they took the field against Tennessee? Because you say it's one of the greatest speeches you ever heard in person.
Yeah, he of course, everybody idolized Bear Bryant, certainly, And they had some great players on the team. And And then the dressing room before the game, I mean, he just he basically said, hey, you know what they say? They say, you know, this player, John David Crow, who was a Heisman Trophy winner, he said, they say, John David Crow, you're not ready to play. And they say, Charlie Kruger, who was the Outland Trophy winner, they say, you know, this. And, you know, he just went right down the line with all the star players, and he said, you know, they say this about you, that you're not ready to play, basically. And at the end of the speech, he said, you know who they are? And everybody kind of looked around, and he said, they is me. And I mean, the players just went crazy. I mean, it was, they busted out the door. And it still sends chills over me, you know, saying, hey, you know, they, because they thought it was the media, you know, that so-and-so or somebody else. And they took it to heart.
Would Bear Bryant work today with athletes? Because you always hear this idea that, well, old school guys that did it this way, it wouldn't translate with today's athlete. But you also hear things about a guy like a Bear Bryant, that he would always evolve as a coach and do different things depending on the era in which he was coaching to make sure he was going to be successful. So do you think that a style like that would translate today with athletes?
Yeah, I think all the great ones would be the same way, you know, Vince Lombardi or Tom Landry or whoever. I mean, they knew how to get players to play, and they knew, you know, and they would adjust with the times, I think. So, yeah, I think, I'm sure he would, you know, he was a great coach then, and it would be a great coach now.
Wade Phillips, our guest, the book is Son of Bomb, which is also his Twitter handle. Wade, what made Earl Campbell the best player you ever scouted? Because at first you did not agree with those in the room who told you and your dad that Earl was the best player that they'd ever seen in college.
Well, I went up to Notre Dame to watch all the, and that at that time, watch all the film on Notre Dame, because they had like 9 players that were drafted that year. And they had played Texas in the Cotton Bowl. And so they played Earl Campbell and beat him. And so I watched all the Notre Dame games, and I said, well, I'll watch the Cotton Bowl and see what it looked like, you know. And Texas blocked nobody in the game. I mean, they just dominated the line of scrimmage. And Earl Campbell made some of the greatest 3-yard runs. He had 80-something yards at the half, but they got behind, so they didn't give him the ball the second half. But he made some of the greatest 3- and 4-yard runs with, you know, 3 and 4 guys trying to tackle him. I mean, I couldn't believe it. I could not believe how good he was. And I realized then that, you know, he was really something.
Wade Phillips with us here on the Midday 180.
Love You Blue is maybe one of the best team city connections in the history of sports, certainly one that we compare a lot of other ones to. When Bud Adams decided to fire your dad at the end of that, despite the fact that it's not like the team was falling apart, you think there was a degree of jealousy there that your dad was so much the head of that and that Bud wasn't?
Oh, I don't know about that. I mean, I really don't know. And, you know, that's when I found out there's two kinds of coaches, ones that have been fired and ones that are going to be fired. My dad always said that, but I didn't think after losing the AFC Championship game 2 years in a row to Pittsburgh, who won the Super Bowl, and then losing to Oakland in the playoffs, who won the Super Bowl, that we would get fired, but we did. So, and, you know, but my dad was not that kind of guy. I mean, in that, I won't say it didn't bother him, but he felt like he worked as hard as he could for Bud Adams, and Bud Adams paid him for every day he worked. So, you know, that's the way he lived life. You know, he didn't have any grudges. He didn't, you know, he didn't look back and say, well, you know, this guy or that guy. He just, and he always respected Bud. So I don't know if I'm that big a man, but he was.
In the book, Wade, you have stories about ownership and how you and the coaches that you worked for dealt with rumors that they would be fired. Ralph Wilson, Arthur Blank, Jerry Jones, Pat Bowlen, and others are examples that you use throughout the book. Who was the most honest owner that you worked for and why?
Most honest? Wow. Pat Bowlen, again, and I told the story. I mean, when he fired me, he came in and cried. He cried on my shoulder, you know, and said he just said it, hey, we need to win more games, you know. So that was about as honest as you could be, I think.
And then Ralph Wilson told you, yeah, go ahead and go to the Senior Bowl, I believe it was. And then he called you as soon as you landed or something and asked you why you didn't fire a coach that you had agreed you would not fire. And that led to you being fired.
Yeah, I was East-West game, but that's exactly what happened. As soon as I got in the hotel, he said, why didn't you fire so-and-so? And I said, well, we talked about that. He said, well, you knew what I wanted. I said, if you want to fire all my coaches, you ought to just fire me. He said, okay, you're fired. So that was it.
How hard will it be to not be part of whatever kind of season is ahead of us now?
Yeah, it's hard. Actually, I was out in 2014, and I was 68 at the time. But I had like three coaches that said, hey, if I get this job, I want you to go with me. Well, they didn't get a job. I laid out in 2014, but I came back in 2015. Kubiak and Elway hired me, at Denver, and we did okay. So, we won Super Bowl 50. So, I still think I can help. I still think I can help this year. You know, I mean, not as a coordinator, but, you know, I can certainly qualify as senior assistant. So,
You'd be up for a consultant role if somebody called you even during the season?
In somewhere, yeah, you bet.
Wade Phillips with us. As a defensive coordinator in San Diego, you worked for Marty Schottenheimer. I believe that was 2004, going 12-4 and reversing that 4-12 record the previous season. And you were always known for turning defenses around from some of the worst to some of the best the year that you arrived. But you described that season working for Schottenheimer as the strangest situation that you were in throughout your coaching career. Tell us, go into detail for us on that. Why was that so strange out in San Diego where you had a lot of success?
After I left, we were 14-2 and I got the Dallas job. I mean, Marty got fired. So that's a pretty strange situation where a coach at 14-2 gets fired. So I think it was just the relationship between the general manager and the head coach, you know, and it was always lacking.
Had you been in a situation where the head coach you worked for gave you complete control of the defense the way Schottenheimer did?
Yeah, sure. Almost everywhere I've been. Yeah.
Because the part of the interview, the first time you interviewed with him, I believe he was comparing you to his brother. He wanted to hire his brother. You were going to run the 3-4, which I know Marty did not do. And in this case, he allowed you to do that out in San Diego.
Right. Well, A.J. Smith, the general manager, had been with me at Buffalo. And so, that was part of the deal. And because I interviewed with Marty, and Marty was very meticulous. Both times I talked to him about a job, we talked for at least 3 hours, maybe 4 hours on the 3-4 defense. So, and then he said, Marty said, hey, at San Diego, he said, well, I got some other people to interview, you know, and I said, okay, I got other people to talk to. And as soon as I got to the airport, he called me and said, hey, we want you for the job. So I don't know exactly what happened in between time, but he said, we want you for the job. And I said, well, good, let's do it. So we did.
Much of what we've read about how your divorce with the Rams came about was Sean's feeling about what unfolded in the Super Bowl, the Rams Patriots Super Bowl. Is that accurately represented, you think, that he wanted things to maybe adjust in a different way than they did or didn't in that game?
Well, we gave up 13 points to Tom Brady, so I don't know that he – no, I don't think that had anything to do with it. I hope not. I mean, we held him to 18 and beat him in Denver and won a Super Bowl. So our defense played pretty good in that Super Bowl.
Wade Phillips has been our guest. Coach, thank you so much for the time. Always love having you on the show, and we've really enjoyed going through this book.
Hey, thanks. I appreciate it. Yeah. I hope people read it. I enjoyed doing it. So, and I wanted to honor my dad, and that I think it does.
Absolutely does. We love those old stories. Thank you so much, Wade.
All right. Thanks.
Wade Phillips has been our guest, and Paul, there's as you go deeper into the book, there's chapters on the interview process for Jerry Jones, Jerry and Steven, and how they go in depth and what kept, you know, what allowed Wade to get that job after he was with San Diego for a couple of seasons. Well, they went 12-4 and 14-2, and he pointed to the defense, then the way that the Chargers defense was prior to his arrival, which was dead last in the league.
Yeah, and he and Vic Carucci do touch on the idea that Bud may be part of the firing of Bum Phillips was that Bud was a little bit jealous of just how much Bum came to be the face of that Love You Blue thing. And I wouldn't put it past Bud at that stage of his life. You know, he liked the cameras. He's a typical eccentric NFL owner. Some would handle a personality like that fantastically well, and others might, you know, think, hey, that guy's getting a little bit too big for his britches, if you will. And it certainly sounded like in that Love You Blue section of that book that Wade felt like that was at play.
Michael Kiss, the Midday 180 winner for our draft analyst competition from 2 years ago. He'll join us today. That will be at 12:15. We'll get into our pill discussion. If you've missed this on social media, where you can only take three pills, you're able to choose from several different options, sixteen different options, and you can only take three pills. Paul, you've printed this off.
I've got a handy printout now, so when I see somebody say 4, 13, and 16. I've got my sheet of paper here.
We're going to go in depth on this at 1 o'clock, take calls on this as well throughout the 1 o'clock hour, have a huge discussion on what might have been with all of these scenarios. It's the Midday 180 queued up by Edley's Barbecue on 104.5 The Zone.
Your home for Titans football and the University of Tennessee Volunteers. 104.5 The Zone.
Midday 180, queued up by Edley's Barbecue, and right now you can download the Edley's app for iPhone or Android by typing Edley's in your app store. It's simple to order great barbecue from your phone, and don't forget tomorrow you've got the Nashville-style hot pulled pork. You can check that out at Edley's Barbecue each Friday. They have curbside pickup available, and they do deliver to certain areas of the Nashville area. You can check them out in 12 South. They're in Nashville. Also, Sylvan Park on Murphy Road. And currently, their East Nashville location under construction following the tornado damage. 615-737-1045, our number. 615-737-1045. Guys, you see where Tom Brady is trademarking the TB times TB logo?
Yeah, do we think that's going to sell off the rack? I mean, it's going to sell off the rack in Tampa Bay. It's not going to sell. It's not a national thing, I wouldn't think, right?
It will sell, and he will make money off of that.
Sure.
It is. I'm telling you, I've said it throughout. High times in Tampa Bay right now for economy, for the sports market, for Tom Brady making money, for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers making money, for sports media that covers the Tampa Bay Buccaneers making money. Just what an amazing windfall for everyone in that region for Tom Brady to pick them and go to that team. And they, I know people right now are in their cars or at their homes rolling their eyes. Oh, well, who cares if they won the press conference and they won the offseason but doesn't equate to wins on the field? Well, I'll tell you who likes winning the offseason, winning press conferences, and winning ticket sales. Owners of teams.
Yeah.
The 32 owners of teams will love that, especially for a team like Tampa, who's now selling a ton of tickets that had a hard time selling tickets before.
Yeah, well, let's divide this into a couple baskets. It's more than winning the offseason. You're winning the press conference is one thing, and winning the press conference doesn't necessarily reap financial rewards. Winning the box office with somebody like this, winning the merchandise, this is beyond the typical thing. This is maxing that out with the greatest modern name, presumably the greatest quarterback of all time, the biggest winner in modern football history, you know, the Michael Jordan. So this is more than winning the press conference. This is a bigger basket. And Chad, we've talked about it thoroughly. The marketing element of this team now, we've never seen a parallel jump for a franchise. And I think we tend to forget just how bad Tampa is because they got to okay and they won a Super Bowl. And so, but think back to the 70s, what this team was. It was so bad. It's historically bad. And now this team has the best quarterback ever. It's way bigger than the Titans getting him would have been. This is akin to, you know, one of the worst teams ever getting him.
Two things.
It's not akin to it. It is it.
The marketing element of this combined with the potential for actual wins on the football field by bringing in Tom Brady and what he can do for that team and what it does for that city is exactly the reason that I picked one of my three pills that we're going to get into later as a tease, and there's a translation there with this. Number two, I'd love to go back and see the financial impact on the Washington Wizards when Michael Jordan came back and played with them at that time, because I'm trying to think of the parallel in sports that we've seen with that. And Paul, you just mentioned the name Michael Jordan. To me, that's the one, is at the very end of his career when he comes back and plays for the Washington Wizards. What was their ticket sale impact? What was, obviously, merchandise was much better with fans in that area and all over the country buying the Wizards Michael Jordan jersey, but I'd like to see the comparisons between the two.
Did we think he was going? This is very interesting that we bring this up. A five-man game, too, where you would think, you know, one guy's going to be of more influence, even though quarterback has obviously the hugely influential position, but he's more reliant on 10 guys with him and on a defense where he's not on the field. One of five players you would think would have more influence. But we didn't expect the Wizards to go win championships, did we? We think Tampa Bay could be an NFC contender off of this. Not an exceptionally talented team that he's joining, but has weapons for him, making some additions now with him. Why is it that we think... I don't remember what else the Wizards had. It wasn't a completely bare cupboard, was it, Chad? I don't know how much you remember about it. But we weren't expecting the Wizards to contend for the NBA championship. And we are thinking Tampa Bay could be at least a Final Four team in the NFL, aren't we?
Correct me if I'm wrong, Chad, but didn't they give Jordan the director of, like, he was like the president of basketball operations or something?
Yeah, he was the president of basketball operations. He basically inserted himself onto the court. With the team, and I'm going to say, what was it, 2001, 2002? I'm looking up the Wizards roster. I remember Kwame Brown was his big pick, right?
Which was
the number one overall pick, which was a total disaster.
Guy carried French dressing in his pocket for when he went to a French restaurant because he was not satisfied.
And the other guy I remember on those teams was Tyronn Lue, who's now the coach in the NBA. Yeah, looking at their this was their roster in 2001, 2002. Kwame Brown. Hubert Davis was still in the league and playing. Richard Hamilton, Brendan Haywood, Christian Laettner was on those teams. Tyronn Lue, those are the only names that you would know. on those teams. But yeah, I mean, there were some nice pieces there.
What was the
expectation? It was not a good team.
What was the expectation?
That they would get in the playoffs. It wasn't a title contending team.
Final four? Probably not.
No.
Coming up, David Reed gives us the news you can use with the COVID-19 updates for the Nashville and local area. Plus, we'll hit headlines of the day at 12:15. Draft analyst Michael Kist returns to the show. We'll discuss SEC and Big Ten talent beyond day one of the NFL draft. It's the Midday 180 queued up by Edley's Barbecue on 104.5 The Zone.